When we see the results of, say, an earthquake, it's shocking, realizing that we live on an earth that, with a small shrug, can do this to human beings. As soon as you lay claim to the physical elements of a body, you're exposed to the physical elements of the world, regardless of where you are, and those outside elements can crush the body without a moment's thought. When you're out in the wilderness, you're even more conscious of that fact. Years back, I was up in Alaska, camping at the Arctic Circle, and even though it was summer, which meant that it was relatively mild, there was still a very strong sense that for hundreds of miles around, there was just nothing but nature and more nature, and nature didn't care about you at all. You could die, and it would be totally indifferent. That gave rise to a sense of awe. It was a real help in practicing concentration, in getting the mind to settle down. On the one hand, the disturbances of being involved in human society were not there. But on the other, nature seemed so much bigger and implacable. Down here in the lower 48, wilderness is just little islands surrounded by a sea of civilization. Up there, it's the other way around. Civilization is little islands, and the wilderness is the sea. It's all around and very sobering. That kind of sobering thought is very useful in the meditation, for it helps to still the mind. Sariputta recommends a similar reflection. Think about the different physical elements in the body. You realize that these elements are the same elements you see outside when there's a storm, a wildfire, an earthquake, a flood. When those elements outside can change in such radical ways, what about this little body you've got here, composed of the same elements? Is there anything constant there? Anything you can really lay hold to as yourself or others? And in response to that question, he says, the body has only a no. It denies your desire for ownership. So it's useful to develop this sense of awe. It helps put things into perspective, that these things we hold on to, the physical body, the affairs of our daily lives, the ups and downs, the concerns about what this person thinks, what that person says, what's going to happen to me, what's going to happen to the people I love, are eventually all going to die. In one way or another, the elements are going to take over. They're going to take everything back. These things we've claimed to be us or ours are going to show that they know nothing of our claims. They have no respect for our claims. That thought focuses you inside. What do you have? You've just got your awareness. You've got the mind. What shape is the mind in? Fortunately, the Buddha doesn't leave us stranded here. All too often in the West, this sense of awe is left simply as an aesthetic sense or a vague religious feeling. But the Buddha gives you further instructions on what to do with it. Take that sense of the earth and think just of the earthness of the earth or the windness of the wind. Don't focus on any of the little details. Make the earthness of earth and how vast it is the object of your concentration. Allow your awareness to take on some of that vastness and then learn how to hold it there. If the elements seem threatening, think of the vastness of space, the space that penetrates all of this activity of the wind and fire and rain. Space penetrates the walls of the meditation hall, the floor, the roof, everything. There's space in all directions, all around us. Learn how to hold that perception. That can form a basis for concentration, and concentration of that sort can put the mind in the right state to reflect on things in their proper perspective, to look at where you cling to things and what might be in your best interest to let go. If you're looking for your happiness in something that the elements could destroy, don't think you have a special pact with them. They're large and overwhelming and don't give a damn. But you can escape their influence. You can escape their power. That's why we're practicing here. to find something that's not subject to all this wind and rain and movement of the earth, the potential for fire. This is a very useful contemplation on not-self, the undependability of the elements, the stress of trying to find happiness in something that those elements could destroy. even if it's not yet being destroyed outright, these elements are just wearing away the elements of the body, the faculties of the body, or abilities to see and smell and taste and hear. To think in these ways really helps us to let go of the attachments that are causing us suffering, that weigh the mind down. So here we are in the midst of a storm, but there's something deep inside that doesn't have to suffer from the storm, doesn't have to be threatened by the storm. Even though we may reflect on the awesomeness of the powers of nature and how huge they are, there is something in the mind that's even more enormous, more solid than they are. It can be found through our own efforts, and it offers a security that you can't find in any place, because it's outside of places. There's a recurrent phrase in the canon of the Arahants being, quote, released everywhere, which means released from everywhere, every place. That idea is awesome, too. The reality of it, once you've touched it, is even more awesome than the idea. It's always helpful to keep these thoughts in mind. And then the second passage that I have is the talk called Strengthening Mindfulness, given on January 4th, 2012. It's the third of a series of five on the five strengths. The breath is something very close to your awareness. As you breathe in and breathe out, it's right here. And so you think it would be very easy to follow. But the mind is like a camera lens whose focal length keeps changing. It's focused here for a bit, and then it's focused somewhere else, then someplace else, and then back here again. They've done studies to show that a moment of attention is just that. It's just a few moments. If you want to watch something continually, you have to learn how to stitch those moments together. Otherwise, you can't make sense out of things. Or the sense you make out of things is just a very rough estimate. So you want to be able to stitch them together very closely, those moments of attention. This is what mindfulness is for. To keep reminding you to stay here with the breath, with the breath, with the breath. And the Buddha recommends that you use two other qualities along with the mindfulness. Alertness, which is watching what is actually going on, and then ardency. Ardency is the energy you put into it to keep reminding yourself, breath, breath, breath. This is one of the reasons that they often use a meditation word to go along with the breath. A traditional one is Buddho, Bud with the in-breath, To with the out-breath. Buddho means awake. It is actually the term the Buddha used to describe himself as someone who is awake. It's a quality of mind that you want to develop. And you can use the word as a marker to remind yourself that you're going to stay here with the in-breath and here with the out-breath. Then with the in-breath again, then with the out-breath again. Because it's only when the mind gets to settle down, then it can let down some of its tension so that it's not constantly ready to jump. And so that you can focus continually on something and really see it for what it is, what the connections are. In other words, how the mind has an impact on the breath, how the breath has an impact on the mind, how the breath has an impact on different parts of the body. Lots of things can be learned if you stay here consistently. So you need to keep reminding yourself, this is where you want to stay. When the Buddha compared different parts of the practice to a farmer's different implements, mindfulness is the goad. Now, the goad is what you use to poke your animal with. Say you've got a water buffalo pulling your plow, and the buffalo starts turning off to the right, turning off to the left, not in the direction you want it to go. You take the goad, which is this long stick with a point on the end, and you poke it to remind it that there is work to be done, and this is where you want the work to go. Another analogy the Buddha uses is of a gatekeeper. The gatekeeper is at a fortress at the very edge of a frontier. There are friendly people who want to come into the fortress, and there are also unfriendly people who want to come into the fortress. And the gatekeeper needs to know who is who. Let in the people who are trustworthy and keep out the people who are not. So mindfulness is not just accepting whatever comes up. It's there to remind you there is a skillful direction that the mind can go, and there is an unskillful direction at any time. And you want to keep it on the skillful direction. Now, to strengthen mindfulness, the Buddha said there are two qualities you need. One is virtue, and the other is right view. Virtue strengthens mindfulness because if you're observing the precepts, you're not harming anybody. You're not harming yourself. You're not harming your friends. You're not harming anybody at all. So that when you reflect on your actions, there's no remorse, no regret. People who have a lot of remorse and regret have learned how to put those things out of their mind. They've done studies to show that people can become very good at forgetting these things, so good that it becomes subconscious. But because the mind then becomes talented at forgetting, it then gets harder and harder to maintain your mindfulness. The mind has all kinds of tricks for slipping off, changing the focal length of that camera lens, and thinking that that's just the most natural thing to do. So one way of strengthening mindfulness is to make sure that your behavior is not the sort that you're going to regret. This is why there's no clear line between the practice of virtue and the practice of meditation. This also strengthens your mindfulness in the sense that if you keep your precepts in mind, you have certain principles that you're going to follow. You're not going to kill. You're not going to steal. You're not going to have illicit sex. You're not going to lie. You're not going to take intoxicants. You keep those things in mind. The easiest of the precepts to break, of course, is the one about lying. And so you have to be really on top of your speech so that your words don't just come out on their own without anything to monitor them. So in developing that quality of being able to monitor, that's how you strengthen mindfulness. As for right view, mindfulness on its own has to have some explanations for what it's doing. It's not just a matter of root willpower that you tell yourself, stay here, stay here, stay here. You have to have your reasons why you are staying here. What are you trying to do as you stay here? And this is where right view comes in to remind you that you're staying here because this is part of the path to the end of suffering, learning how to develop concentration. And the path to the end of suffering is something you want to develop. That's why you're training the mind. You're also training the mind because the path to cause suffering is something that the mind is very adept at, to keep yourself from wandering off into that path. That's something you want to let go. So these are duties you have to do here. There's something to be done. You're not just sitting here passively accepting experience as it comes along. You're actively shaping it. That's something you have to understand too. An important part of developing the steps to mindfulness of breathing is understanding the process of what the Buddha calls fabrication. It's the way the mind shapes things through its intentions. There was once a monk who said he practiced mindfulness of breathing simply by letting go of the past, letting go of the future, and just staying focused on the present. And the Buddha said that there is that kind of breath meditation, but it doesn't give the best results. And he set out 16 steps. And a repeated feature of those 16 steps is that you see the different ways in which you're fabricating your experience, and then you learn how to do it more skillfully as you're breathing in, as you're breathing out. In particular, the Buddha focuses on three things. One is the way the breath fabricates your experience of the body. When you breathe in, where do you feel it? Is the breath comfortable? Could you make it more comfortable? How can you make the influence of the breath on the way you feel the body more positive? How can you get it to be calm so that it feels soothing to breathe in, soothing to breathe out, soothing for both the body and then into the mind? The other type of fabrication is what the Buddha calls mental fabrications, and that's two things, perception and feeling. Feeling is the feeling of pleasure or pain, or neither pleasure nor pain. Of course, that relates to the way you breathe. Some ways of breathing have an impact on the level of pleasure or pain in the body. And pains in particular have an impact on the way you breathe. Sometimes you're holding a pain in one part of the body for fear that it will spread, so you tense up around it. And as you tense up around it, that's going to have an impact on the way you breathe. You're actually cutting off the breath energy to that part of the body. And it's going to make the breath a less and less pleasant experience itself. And you get in this bad feedback loop. This is one of the reasons why, if you find you're breathing around a particular part of the body that you're avoiding, consciously try to breathe into it. Or if you're trying to pull the breath past something, breathe into that as well. Because sometimes you have the habit of holding on to a particular part of the body even when the pain is gone. You may have noticed that if you hurt your foot and start developing a limp, sometimes the limp is still with you even after the pain in the foot has gone away. This is one of the reasons why we survey the whole body to get a sense of where the breath is being blocked, where it's being held back, and then consciously think I'm breathing into that. This is where perception comes in, the other mental fabrication. What kind of picture do you have of the breathing process? When you breathe in, what pulls the breath in? Is there anything you have to push against or pull against? That's going to create tension right there. How about thinking of the breath simply as energy, flowing through all the nerves? It's already flowing. It's simply a matter of allowing it to flow better. As you breathe in, the breath comes in and out the pores. You don't have to pull it in through the nose or pull it past any tension in your neck or chest, or fight with any tension in your abdomen. Think of the breath energy penetrating all these things and nourishing them very directly. You don't have to go past them. Go right into them. See what that perception does. So you've got these three elements here: breath, feeling, perception. And they have an impact on one another. So there's plenty to explore here. A lot of people find breathing a very dull thing to watch. It's just in and out, and that seems to be about it. But if you realize that there's this element of perception that influences the breath, and feelings that influence the breath, and the breath influences your perceptions and feelings, you've got something to explore. That's something you want to keep in mind. Now, if that's too much to keep in your mind, just go back to staying with the breath energy and holding in mind the perception of the breath energy as this energy that flows easily in and flows easily out. And it's soothing, refreshing. And as you find it easier and easier to stay there, to keep that in mind, then you can start adding these other elements, exploring other ways you can shape the experience of breathing through your perceptions, other ways you can use the way you breathe to create a greater and greater sense of calm. Because in all these cases, the Buddha says you want to take this element of fabrication and make it more calm, make it more tranquil, more soothing. As the breath gets more refined, the events in the mind, what the mind is doing, come more and more to the fore. After all, that's why we're here. We're here to train the mind. We're using the breath as a means to train the mind. And you want to get your attention settled very clearly here in the present moment. Keep the focal length right here. Don't go zooming out or zooming away. Zoom right in on the present moment. and stay here, so you can see these things more and more clearly. So these are the qualities we're trying to develop, and this is what we want to keep in mind. This is why we're focusing on the breath. So when the mind complains that it's getting boring staying with the breath, or it wants to move around a little bit, you have your reasons. It's not just ordering the mind to stay here. You have an understanding why this is important. It makes it easier and easier to strengthen your mindfulness, to make it more consistent. So it really does become a dominant factor in the mind. So you want to stay right here, right here. And you develop that quality of mind that monitors whether you're staying right here. And if you notice that you're slipping off, you refocus the mind. Refocus the mind. In the beginning, it may seem tedious, but it's really important. And this is where the understanding, this is where right view comes in, to remind you why you're here, to give you the motivation to stick with it until you start seeing results. Then the results feed into your ability to stay more mindful. You have to be careful, of course, when the sense of pleasure develops. It's very easy to lose your focus with the breath and move over to the pleasure. So again, you've got to remind yourself, hey, stay here with the breath. There's still work to be done. It's the mindfulness that keeps you focused. And this is why mindfulness practice and concentration practice are so intimately connected. If you didn't have this ability to remind yourself, you couldn't stay concentrated on anything for very long at all. So we're here to focus on the breath and to ferret out the breath so you can see more clearly how it's related to the other things that are very similar to it and other things that have an impact on it. Because that way, we get to understand the mind, and the more we understand the mind, the more clearly we can distinguish between the cause of suffering and the path to the end of suffering, and keep ourselves more and more consistently on the path.
When were those talks given?
Let's see. So, AWE was January 21st, 2010.
And the other one was July 4th, 2012. You said that.
Okay. January 4th, 2012.
January 4th. Mm-hmm. I never heard Samvega translated that way. It's like fear or even terror.
Terror.
You heard that
word? I hadn't. No.
Yeah. It's a evocative word. Okay. Assembly seems contented.